Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable for this Monday, the 9th of September. Very nice to have you with us for the Roundtable panel. And we are happy that you came around and decided to listen to us for a bit, hopefully for a while, and we welcome you. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love your take on the issues that we tackle this morning. Let me introduce the group to you. We have a great one, and we'll talk about the interesting stories from the last several days over the weekend that that occurred. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, good morning to you, Joseph. I'm just fine. And good morning to all you other roundtable panelists.
Well, those roundtable panelists are excited as well. We have Judy Patrick with us. She is Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. And it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Good morning. And it was a wild weekend in news, wasn't it?
Yes.
Lots to talk about.
Man. Okay. Sarah Rogerson is here. She's Albany Law School professor, director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. And Skidmore College business professor and Brexit expert and all-around cool guy, Peter Maloney, is here. Good morning.
All right. Thank you. That's a great introduction. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Great. You did a lovely commentary that aired that people could listen to online. It was really cool. It puts a lot of this in perspective, which we'll get to in a few moments. But the big story, of course, is the one we have to talk about, and that is over the canceling of the secret meeting with the Taliban that was going to take place at Camp David, but then was canceled because of an event that happened that the president may or may not have been aware of at the time of the cancellation, just days before 9/11. Okay, so here's what we know so far, and it's not a lot, but here's what we know. The New York Times has done some incredible reporting on this. Even as President Trump blamed a recent Taliban attack for his decision to call off nearly year-long negotiations with the insurgents, officials suggested on Sunday it had more to do with the Taliban's resistance to the American terms for a peace deal and a rushed plan for a Camp David summit meeting. Talks that once seemed on the verge of a breakthrough had hit a wall over how the deal should be finalized and announced, with the president himself showing more engagement in the talks in recent weeks after boiling criticism of a deal that was finalized in principle. The Trump administration had set in motion a daring gambit: fly the insurgents' leaders and the Afghan leader to American soil. At Camp David, the traditional retreat of many presidents, separate meetings with each side would then lead to a grand announcement by Mr. Trump, according to Afghan, Western, and Taliban officials with knowledge of the peace talks. The Americans were also rushing to finalize outstanding issues, including disagreements over prisoner release, before the meeting on Sunday. The Taliban leaders, however, having refused to negotiate directly with the Afghan government until after the group had an agreement with the United States, had compared the proposal to the Americans tricking them into political suicide. All right, so there's the Cliff Notes version. Alan, what do you make of it?
Well, you'll remember Woodrow Wilson and the whole concept of secret agreements secretly arrived at, not a good idea. The whole idea of a democracy, it seems to me, is that people will be aware of what their government is doing in their name, and then they can either check in favorably or unfavorably. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that this stuff doesn't go on, but this really is a pretty good example of it, how it all breaks down, and it makes, once again, the president, who has not enjoyed a lot of success in these areas, look like a bit of a fool.
So a couple of things that I don't understand about it. We found out about it because he broke the story on Twitter and said that I canceled the meeting. he had to have known what the ramifications were going to be. It seems like just that could have been handled. If you're trying to save face, it seemed that that could have been handled with a bit more polish.
This is the president of the United States who on many, many occasions has messed up. And he has messed up by assuming that if he tweets something or if he twits something, he'll be off the hook. Of course, you know, he just has no great idea of what he's doing. The problem is that the foolish people in the Senate stick with him, and his voters stick with him for all the other reasons we've discussed so many times.
You know, his supporters over the weekend or on Sunday were saying he issued that tweet because he was trying to control the narrative. He didn't want the Taliban to be the one to say what was happening. But also we're hearing reports this morning that that essentially had a deal. What he was trying to do was make Americans believe he was, in fact, negotiating the deal at Camp David when it was already done, to give people the illusion that he was this great peacemaker.
Exactly.
When, in fact, he was not.
Exactly. There's a difference between the deal that was actually being negotiated, the actual diplomacy that was going on, and Trump's handling, or what Trump has to say about that diplomacy, right? And he's probably very intentionally not being briefed as completely as former presidents might be on the diplomatic efforts that took place like a week ago, right, in Doha.
Yeah.
Right? So there was actually like legitimate diplomatic correspondence. The New York Times had a reporter embedded there, which is, I understand, really difficult access to get. And that reporter actually sat down with one of the chief negotiators from the Taliban to get a better understanding. So there's a lot more going on, and we can talk about how Trump handled it, which is usually, we all know where that conversation leads.
So is there anybody in this room now who has any great faith that the Taliban is can be counted on to keep their word once they make it? Because I do not.
No. But I also have, I mean, no is the answer to your question, I think. But I did find it interesting that in the New York Times, as they were reporting, they were saying, according, I'm trying to find the exact wording of it, but basically they were, according to Afghan, Western, and Taliban officials with knowledge of the peace talks, meaning that that information seemed to be more solid than the information that the American government was giving them.
Yes.
That's frightening.
But makes a lot of sense given the power dynamics. I mean, some of what the New York Times has also been reporting is this tricky diplomatic arrangement where there's a lot of perception around who wins. Do the Afghan people win? Does the Taliban win? Are they one and the same? And it's a battle over the soul of this country. Our interest, our stake in the game is whether or not to leave our troops in. Right. And that's
exactly
a very
right.
different analysis as opposed to what does democracy look like, if at all, in Afghanistan.
And to your point, Alan, it is interesting to me because with what you said, which seems to be exactly right, then why take the chance at all, number one? And two, we do have to talk about the timing of this, of just, you know, the week of 9/11 of the anniversary just seems to be rather tone deaf.
I think he is, the president is desperate to get those troops out of Afghanistan, and he's willing to make a bad deal. Because if I know that the Taliban isn't going to keep their words, and you know that the Taliban isn't going to keep their words, he certainly knows it, and he doesn't seem to give a damn. And that is what is so risky here.
And yes. He wants to get them out for political purposes.
Exactly.
The election is next year. He's agreed to a time frame of 15 or 16 months, which now the Taliban knows that. He's lost his negotiating power.
Peter.
Yeah, so I agree with what you guys are saying. I mean, Sarah mentioned the power dynamics, and if I understand correctly, it was Taliban-U.S. negotiations, and they kind of co-opted in the Afghan government of the country they're talking about towards the end. They agreed to turn up, apparently. But it seems strange that this will be the government of that country, and they haven't had an input into discussions so far. It seems a bit curious to me.
It does. And also now, where are we now, after everything has sort of imploded? Are we back to square one, or?
Well, one thing here, Joe, if the President of the United States is telling the Afghanistan government, we're out, they don't have an awful lot of choice. Am I wrong about that, gang? They don't have a lot of choice. They sort of have to go along with it. There's not much they can do. And after all these years of us and the Russians and everybody else in there, we pretty well know what the Taliban will do. They'll agree to this. And then as soon as they're there, they're going to do what they've always done. They're going to start cutting heads off.
You know, apparently part of the peace agreement or part of this agreement would allow for the release of 1,000 Taliban prisoners. Again, they haven't really brought us, clued the Afghan government that these people in the prisons are going to be released. It's something that is being left for another day. And that whole other day we'll have questions about whether women will once again be, you know, exactly, restricted in unfathomable ways, and whether things will revert to the way they were before. It was all for naught.
Do you have any doubt about it, Judy?
No, I don't. No, I don't. But, you know, at some point, the president said he called off this Camp David summit because of this bombing last week in Kabul. But we're all along, for the past year, when they've been negotiating this deal, tensions have continued, bombings, firing. People have died on both sides for the past year. So what was it about this one bombing and where one U.S. soldier was tragically killed, I mean, that prompted it? Was just an excuse.
Absolutely.
And what was the excuse for? I think the president holds his hand up in the air with his White House people and says, uh-oh, we're going to get clobbered here.
Yeah.
And that's what this was all about.
Yeah. I mean, there are some analysts on Twitter, hot takes on Twitter. if the president can announce foreign policy on Twitter, I think we can have hot takes on Twitter, too. But that basically the Camp David summit was never booked. And this was just, David Frum calls it vaporware, that the president was sort of just playing around with this idea, trying to intervene in the diplomatic conversation that had already been happening while saving face. And he says,
so this is David Frum.
David Frum, he says that they canceled a summit that had never been booked, which is probably just as well, because if Trump had negotiated with the Taliban as he negotiated with Kim Jong-un, they would have walked away from Camp David with Trump's lunch money in their pocket and an empire stretching to Uzbekistan. So that's, the idea is that Trump really didn't have a lot of, or felt disempowered, but knew enough to see where the direction of the talks were headed, and didn't have a lot of faith in his team to be able to.
I think also the Taliban were aware that the major chip on the table the U.S. has is having troops on the ground. And once that's taken off the table, leverage is clearly lost.
That's it. Mm.
Again, I go back to, so where are we now when it comes to, it seems like this clouds everything of the future of those negotiations, what happens to the troops, as well as the marking of the anniversary of 9/11 and how we look at that over the next 48 and 72 hours.
Yeah, I think it's the 18th anniversary this year.
It is.
And what we're hearing is that the U.S. will start withdrawing troops anyway, and they won't make a big deal about it, but that's what will happen. Whether or not Trump can use this as a campaign tool is yet to be decided, but I think the Taliban at this point has the upper hand.
So what do the American people say when he withdraws the troops? You're a hero? Or do they say it's a disgrace, 9/11, the Twin Towers? That's what he's thinking about right now.
I think it depends on how you feel about Trump. But what concerns me is that the Taliban seems to say, not only are we not coming back to the table, but we're going to step up our
terrorist attacks,
our attacks on Americans.
Yeah. And the which probably would play to the president's narrative, correct?
I don't know. It depends on what he says about it.
Yeah.
I mean that the Taliban can't be trusted, that they're a vicious group?
Right.
Well, why was he negotiating with them for the past year then?
I do think that the secret talks thing is interesting, because why would you have secret talks and sometimes it doesn't work? But one example I'll give you guys is when the British government talked to the Sinn Féin representatives in Northern Ireland, it was going on for years in secret. If that had been exposed, it would have been incredibly damaging for the British government. But lucky for them, it has worked out. So one part of me says it's a smart strategy if you're not sure of the outcome, but obviously if it goes wrong.
Well, and if you have sophisticated negotiators at the,
and if you know who the players are on both sides. I mean, you know, let's face it, both the Irish and the English had a reason for doing what they were doing. Everybody knew where they wanted to go. They were people of integrity. They needed to do it. The Taliban, we know who they are. We know who they are.
I mean, it's not like Obama didn't struggle to get out of Afghanistan, because he did. It's complicated. It's not as easy as buying a piece of real estate in Manhattan and building a condominium.
It's the graveyard of empires, it's called.
Yeah. And not paying for it, by the way.
Well, there is that as well.
With the Taliban, we really only until recently knew their first names. You know, I mean, there's a lot about this that's shrouded in secrecy. You don't even know if the people that you're dealing with are actually the people that they say that they are. There are some people that we still don't know what their faces look like.
I realize we only have a minute, but doesn't this get down to our overall, and I'm certainly thinking what Sarah said a moment ago about, you know, probably depends on what you think about Trump, but the just of how much faith we can have, or trust is perhaps a better word, in the negotiating skills of the United States and what we're able to, what's going on that we don't know about that is, diplomatically speaking, happening behind closed doors.
Okay, so it's particularly, I know it's a little time, Joe, but it's particularly disgraceful that he is negotiating something where he knows, the same way that the people sitting around this panel know and people listening to the radio know, that the Taliban won't be trusted to keep their word, but he's so desperate to get out of Afghanistan that he'll take the bad deal. And this is what's so disgraceful, knowing what's going to happen as a result.
Right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'd love to hear what you have to say on this topic, as well as the others we'll be discussing this morning. Panel@WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us for this Monday program. We have Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Sarah Rogerson, and Peter Maloney. We are talking about the president, and I want to move on to some other stuff. Did anybody want to add anything before we?
No, but I wanted to ask Peter a question.
Go. Sure.
As our Irish observer of the situation. Where is all of that coming down with Brexit right now? What are the Irish saying?
Oh, so can I go into the?
Sure.
Okay, so let's go into the what happened over this weekend. Let me just set it up, if I may. It was a week that began with Parliament defeating the Prime Minister as part of MPs' attempt to block a no-deal Brexit. Then came a proposal, so far rejected, for an early election, Tory sackings, and court battles over the Prime Minister's decision to suspend Parliament from next week until mid-October. Things didn't get much quieter over the weekend. So real quick, Amber Rudd announced that she was leaving and quitting work as the Work and Pension Secretary. Then the Tories targeted John Bercow. Am I correct on that? And I'm sorry?
He's a Speaker of the House.
Speaker of the House. And that happened as well. And then we look at the possibilities of a legal showdown. And we're still, and there's just a fascinating opinion piece in the Boston Globe that I looked at, which was about just this weird thing about brothers and Boris Johnson's brother saying, okay, enough, and the dynamic between those two people. And I know this is far more important than
Bojo versus Jojo, right?
Right. So it's far more important than a sibling rivalry, but damn.
It's good drama.
Yeah. All right, so what do we make of it all?
Has anybody ever seen anything implode as fast as this guy's prime ministership? My goodness.
You know, you say that, but that I you never know. He's a survivor. He's a wily politician. He's definitely walked himself into a corner here of his own making. But if he can pitch it people versus parliament or liberal elite, he'll get some. The Brexit Party, for example, their supporters would be attracted by that. So I agree, it's kind of crazy, but we live in a crazy world. You never know what's going to happen. Electorally, I think he's on the wrong path, but for his purposes, he's making all the right noises for the kind of people he wants to attract.
But what happens then? What happens as far as, I mean, that election still has to happen, and when it happens. And
timing is very important.
Right.
Yeah. There's a meeting taking place on October 19th in the European Union where Johnson has to go, and that should be the closure, whichever is going for no deal or deal. Will the election happen before then? Will it happen after then? It's all strategy. But at the moment, he's lost control. So he's going to have another attempt to call an election today. It's probably going to fail because you need 2/3 majority to make that happen. There's other options where he can pass a piece of legislation and say, we're going to have an election, and that needs 50% support. So there's still doubt that he will even get that because he's a minority government. But an election is going to happen because a minority government can only last for a limited time period. Now he's also fired 21 of his party members, and his brother walked. So, you know, where does it stop? But the bottom line is that he's lost power in the sense that he cannot dictate the direction the parliament goes anymore. They've seized control of that, which is kind of their right as the official representatives of the people. But he still paints it in terms of people versus parliament, which is a powerful tool, just inaccurate. So yeah, it's so much up in the air. But I think fundamentally, they don't even trust him. If they do pass this law today, the Queen's going to sign off on it. They don't even trust him to bring that law to Brussels to say, right, my Parliament says we need an extension. I'm obliged to ask for an extension. The argument his side are making is, we can find ways around that. I mean, yeah, you can break the law. But when the Prime Minister
starts
breaking
the law...
But
you don't know what he's going to say behind closed doors.
Well, what he could do is he could go and send a letter first,
yeah,
and then have a second letter attached saying, we actually don't mean any of this.
Okay.
And that would really annoy, as you can understand, the EU.
Yeah.
But he would have fulfilled his official role as asking for an extension. But the little addendum at the end would say, you know what? In reality, we're not interested.
Maybe he could book Camp David. So
I heard it's free. I heard it's free.
I think they had some openings. But as far as, and then there's also this fascinating aspect. There's so many fascinating aspects to this. But then there is a Brexit Party.
Yep.
And the Brexit Party doesn't have a seat in the Parliament. And yet, you then, if there is an election held, then what role does that party have in gaining support for Boris Johnson, who they don't really like anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Brexit Party was born of Nigel Farage's most recent return to politics after being a member of the European Parliament and then being involved before that in UKIP, which is kind of the predecessor of the Brexit Party. But the Brexit Party is obviously, as the name suggests, a one-issue party. And they are sucking votes away from the Conservatives if the Conservatives stay in the middle ground. If the Conservatives veer to the right, they will take back votes from the Brexit Party. So when the election occurs, if Boris can sell his party as the party that will or has delivered Brexit, then that's going to diminish the Brexit Party's vote. They were like 28% in May in the European election. So they're a significant player, but they're a protest vote, essentially. And the Conservatives are trying to occupy that right side of the spectrum. And in a way, they're actually achieving that for now.
Is it fair to say that nobody knows what the hell they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, they all have their strategies, but there's so many moving parts here that they can fall apart pretty quickly. What's clear is that there's a fundamental blockage in the system between Parliament's power and the people's voice. Now, that has never really happened before because Parliament has been the people's voice. But because they did a referendum in a system that was not designed to hold referendums and the result went the opposite way, the Parliament votes, then you've got a real problem because you do officially have people versus Parliament.
And to Alan's earlier question, the other thing we didn't find out, we still don't know, is the proposal for replacing the backstop plan, which is the insurance policy to avoid a hard border in Ireland. That's been a major stumbling block. Boris Johnson is on the record saying that he accepted the onus of it being on the UK to come up with alternatives to the existing plan. I don't want to give the guy too much of a free pass, but you know there are other things going on. But this has really not been a part of the conversation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he was in Ireland today, actually, talking to our prime minister. But he's been paying lip service. He's never visited the border, for a start, but he's been paying lip service to keeping the border open. Yet everything he's been gearing towards otherwise is pointing, with no deal, is pointing towards a border. So, you know, I know who I believe and I know who I don't trust. But the problem with Northern Ireland is that it's such a potentially volatile location that you can't mess with them in that way. You can't mess with any of your people in that way, but especially there.
Could you just do a little bit of background for all of us on where everybody stands? In other words, the Irish Republic, the Northern Ireland, so that we all get it.
Well, we'll start with the current British government. They want, as Boris said at one point, he'd prefer be dead in the ditch than not deliver a no-deal Brexit. So we kind of know where he stands there. Lots of folks are looking for ditches at this point in Britain. But the leader of the opposition, the Labour Party, who is the prime opposition party, you would think, having mishandled for the past 3 years, the government mishandling for the past 3 years would be an opportunity for a strong opposition to take the reins. Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, is almost as disliked as Boris in certain sectors. So Boris is benefiting from having a weak opposition, because Corbyn is seen as an arch, almost a communist, and the idea of having him in Downing Street is unacceptable to a lot of people. So Boris is obviously playing up on that fear. In the north, you have the nationalist community who want the status quo, who want things to remain the same. They've all
voted. North of what?
Northern Ireland, sorry, yeah.
Okay, right.
They voted Remain, yet they are now being forced to go along with the rest of the UK to leave. So there's a whole democratic question there. But besides that, it's the majority there would still be in favour of an open border, and preferably no Brexit. But that's another issue. And finally, the Irish, the Republic, they wake up every morning going, what did we do to deserve this? But they are just fearful that economically, socially, politically, this is a time bomb. And it just hasn't gone off yet, but it's already caused damage. And they are wanting to keep an open border. They're trying to. The irony here is that the Irish are probably the best allies of the British once you enter the EU arena. Because we've in the past 20 years at least, been very supportive of open markets, deregulation, etc. So the irony is that the British are hurting the one country who's most likely to help them in future negotiations. And make no mistake, if there's a no deal, the issues will still be the same. Money, citizens' rights, and also the backstop. It's not going to go away after October 31st, but there will be no leverage for the British once they're a third party at that stage, unfortunately.
Okay, another naive question for me. Is there a possibility here? A lot of us have always thought about this, that the Irish would be unified sooner or later. What does all of this do to that?
You're asking me a question that will divide my family, not just any family. You know, it's always been our kind of, I grew up in a system where we glorified the heroes of 1916 and the Republic. And our goal was to unite the country. It was in our constitution until about 10, 20 years ago that we did actually own the North. We took it out for the Good Friday Agreement. But it is a kind of a romantic notion we've had in the South. But it's a little bit like, you know, when it actually lands in your lap, potentially, you kind of say, you know what, maybe I don't want it in the end. I liked it because we could never have it. But now that we can have it, I'm not sure I want it. Does that sound familiar? So, yeah, it's complicated.
Well, have conditions changed? I mean, for example, it's always Protestant and Catholic. Apparently, a lot of that has changed.
It has, on the surface, which is good. No one's been really killed in 20 years, but underneath there is there's still segregation.
Is that true that no one has been killed?
Because
when we visited Belfast last August,
there was a woman killed earlier this year, a journalist for
and,
sure.
Yeah. Well, there's that, but then there are still the walls, the fencing, the fires, the violence.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. It wasn't real settling staying there.
Indeed. Yeah. Where did you – were you in Belfast or
– Yeah, right in Belfast.
Yeah. Belfast is a particular area, but and it's majority Protestant, but Derry, for example, is majority Catholic.
Right.
But the idea is that 20 years have passed since the agreement, and there hasn't been – arms have been taken out of the equation. There's lots of violence for sure, but a kind of a low-level simmering, which – some people say Brexit will provide an excuse for them to take it to the next level, and that's the risk. Because these people haven't gone away. It's 20 years ago. They're still alive. And several of them are happy and willing to go back to the old ways.
And they're still ticked.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. 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 I mean, on both sides.
Right.
The unionists, because they felt they gave away the house in the Good Friday Agreement, and the nationalists, that they're just afraid of being... again, dominated by the unionist majority.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Sarah Rogerson, and Peter Maloney on the program this morning. We welcome your letters. We have a few to read with to you, and we welcome yours as well. Panel@WAMC.org. So James writes, great show. Do you trust what Trump says? ? Can you tell what is true and not true? ? Is the Taliban situation true? ? Difficult of picking truth on something that is for real. How can you run a government when people are forced to go along with whatever they're told because they have no way to know the reality?
Right.
Good one.
When you can't even trust a weather map.
Right.
Well,
that's what I was thinking. You know, the weather guys come along and they say, no, this isn't true. And the White House says to everybody, you shut up and do whatever you're told.
And tell them it's true.
I think we, and you know, all of us, well, I've always known when any sort of accord or agreement was reached that obviously there were many, many things that happened that weren't reported on that we'll never know, or that we'll know like 50 years later when somebody finally has like declassified the conversation. And I think that's just baked into American diplomacy and American politics. I don't really want to know what the book reads 50 years from now. That's terrifying, actually. And that's more deeply unsettling to me. It's like we used to be able to sort of suspend reality and watch the movie of international relations and sort of feel confident that we're promoting democracy. And
the grown-ups were running the show.
And the grown-ups were running the show, and we're all going to be okay.
But I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you, except that it seems the difference in... It seems that the difference is that at that time, under the we'll find out in 50-year model, that everyone was keeping their mouth shut. And now we have now we have somebody going, oh, here's what's going in the sausage. We're putting in the rat lips now. Here it goes.
Well, rat lips.
There are no secrets.
Well, no. And Trump, didn't he? He tweeted an airstrike. A classified photograph of an air, and I was like,
well, that's what I mean.
I felt dirty looking at it. I was like, I'm not supposed this is I should look away.
Like I stumbled across some sort of porn on my computer.
You know, Sarah, I really do want to know what's going on, not only 50 years from now, but now. Because I don't think you can have a legitimate
me
discussion
too.
Of government.
No, right. I desperately do. That's the problem, is that I used to be able to self-soothe thinking like, I don't know, but it'll be okay. And
well, you were, the soothing was is that there are many interests, there's a lot going on, but hopefully everyone is involved in this for the good of the world.
Yeah, and there are smart people.
Yes. Yeah,
but we already know that's not true, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, now, yes, that's, and I think that's the point, right?
It's the biggest problem.
Yeah, Yeah. It's sort of like when you get into a cab and the cab is like careening down the sidewalk at 80 miles an hour. This is a Jerry Seinfeld line. You're like, oh, they must know what they're doing. You know, like, oh,
you might
put
your seatbelt on just in case.
Right. Well, they know what they're doing. Jamie says Trump considers foreign policy issues the same way he considers dinner reservations. He considers neither until he is either physically hungry or emotionally needy. At least dinner will satiate his need for bad food. As for his need for praise and attention, there is not enough to ever make him happy. The problem is there is so much more at stake when he suddenly becomes emotionally unhinged.
Yeah, he should have. He could have tweeted, the Taliban isn't my type anyway.
That's such a five. John says, I heard Ms. Patrick say that the Taliban have the upper hand over the U.S. and Afghanistan and thought, of course they do. I thought we learned something about home field advantage when it comes to warfare in Vietnam. They relearned it in Iraq. Now we're going to get schooled again in Afghanistan. We're exceptional, all right, exceptionally thick-headed. Robert says, from what I've read in the New York Times and other news outlets, the main promise that the Taliban has been asked to make is to not allow the Al-Qaeda and ISIS to have bases in Afghanistan. I don't say why they wouldn't keep that promise, as the Taliban has never been an internationally ambitious group, and both of those terrorist organizations would probably compete with it for power in Afghanistan if they get a toehold.
True.
And they can always be in Pakistan.
I did enjoy the, I think it was the Washington Post, of publishing all of the 2012 tweets of President Trump taking President Obama to task for negotiating with terrorists.
It's your weekly entertainment whenever
his
old tweets.
Now for another page of Hypocrisy 101.
Yeah.
Sheila writes, the Taliban aren't any more trustworthy than their U.S. counterparts. After years of Afghanistan being used for proxy wars between both superpowers and regional powers, it is no wonder that the Taliban holds sway over Afghans. By the way, making it possible for girls to go to school should be one of the America's goals. That movement needs to be more organic and come from within. Centuries-old traditions don't change simply because the ugly American decides to spend millions of dollars, frequently resulting in unanticipated and adverse consequences.
Malala, speaking of Nobel Peace Prizes, if you want to win a Nobel Peace Prize, which Trump has indicated he would feels like he might deserve, do it like Malala.
All right.
But there's that line in the letter which I'm still pondering, which is that why the Taliban holds sway over the Afghan people, and then the juxtaposition of the question of what happens to women in Afghanistan and what's right. I have some problems with that section of the letter, although the rest of it sounds somewhat reasonable.
I thought it was very sad that it started with the Taliban. Taliban can be trusted no more than the U.S. Like, really? I thought that we could trust the U.S. I know I'm naive on this one, but I mean, I thought we were a respected world power, but now the letter writer puts us on a par with the Taliban in terms of you can't trust anyone. Just want to put a plug in here. You can trust the media, though. I think they've done some fine reporting trying to ferret out what's going on in these negotiations. Mm-hmm. And there are some intelligent people involved, and the reporters are trying to get to the bottom of it.
Once again, Judy, my only objection to that would be the media. You're right. Some media.
Agreed.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will return and we will go to our Act 3 and hit up some other stories that are making news. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Sarah Rogerson, and we have Peter Maloney here as well. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. George in Albany writes, good morning, panel. Interesting conversation. I have a question for Peter. Can't Northern Ireland photos to... Oh, I think this must be. Basically, the question is, could Northern Ireland secede from the UK and remain in the Commonwealth?
Northern Ireland is, and we touched on this during the break, is economically an unviable part of the UK. So they've always relied on transfers from London and from Brussels recently. If they seceded, the next obvious choice would be, would they join the Republic? Because that's kind of almost half the population are so inclined. But that's a democratic decision down the road. Secede and be on their own is probably not going to work. It's just unviable economically, unless the British kept paying for their needs. But yeah, it's unlikely because there's so much political will to stay in the UK, but also if Brexit happens, to look towards the Republic, to become part of the Republic. But that's kind of a long way down the road. But the fact that it's even on the table is because of Brexit. It was in the Good Friday Agreement, kind of put in as a tiny little paragraph at the end. But it's only since Brexit that has become, people have thought, you know what, maybe there is a plan B. But that's the way it's been.
Peter writes, it was reported quietly this weekend that Prime Minister Johnson has the idea he can only force a better agreement with the EU if they really believe the UK is going to crash out of the EU. What do you think the viability is of such an approach?
Of crashing out? Yeah, I mean, it's a nuclear option, and you know, it's leverage for Johnson, which annoys him so much that Parliament have now taken it away. He's more believable than Theresa would have been. Theresa May would have been, I guess, in that sense. But it's just cutting your nose off to spite your face. It's an economic. The issues will still be the same. You still have to approach the EU to negotiate deals on a trade deal and future relationship, after having effectively trashed their house, burned down the yard, left, and come back in, then to say, let's negotiate a sweet deal going forward. It's unlikely.
Okay, so we have more letters on this, but let me just break for a second to ask this question, which I meant to ask earlier. They hold an election. Let's say they call for an election. Who's going to run against this guy? Like, who wants that job?
Yeah, no, it's true, but power, you know, power is attractive. Who wanted Theresa's job? But obviously, there was like 10 candidates at the start who were happy to go for it. It depends where we are when the election happens. If there's a deal agreed, then it's a different story than now. If it's after November, if it's after October 31st, and there's a no deal, that's a different situation again. So it kind of depends on where we are and when we are. But the one thing I would say about Boris is one kind of nuclear option, which is strange to think of, is he could actually put forward a proposal today of no confidence in his own government.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like crazy. But that's, they're talking about that in a serious way, because the opposition don't want him to win the vote of no confidence, because it would mean giving him the power back to you know, set the date of the election, etc. But
so he's basically saying,
this is where you are.
Please, like, approve the fact that you have no confidence in me.
Exactly. And by the way, I'm going to run for election in 4 weeks' time. Right. So vote for me. So that's, yeah, that's where we are.
Have confidence in me today, but yeah, a couple weeks from now,
give
please
me time.
Be
give
confident.
Me time. Yeah, so it's that's where we are.
Lucy writes, just curious why Peter said that the Irish don't really want the island to be united. I think you explained that, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, if you ask people, again, as I said, romantically and almost in our fibers, it's something that was popular in the Republic and among the nationalists in the North. But in today's day and age, people have kind of seen that, you know, Northern Ireland joining would probably increase our population by, whatever, 25-30%. And as I said, it's a kind of it's an unviable state in itself. So Dublin would then have to provide a lot of money to help Northern Ireland. And then you'd have a minority in Northern Ireland, the Unionists, who would not be happy with that. So I guess it's not correct to say the Irish don't want it. It's just that they're seriously, when faced with a possibility of it happening, they're considering all the negatives as well as all the positives.
Significant pragmatic concerns.
Well, this is it. Yeah.
Mary Alice writes this about Ireland and says, great show as always. I have family on both sides of the border in Ireland. I visited the north in 97 and experienced the tension and fear caused by tank soldiers with automatic rifles walking down the main street and raids occurring on businesses. My many visits since have seen a world of change, and despite the fact that there continues to be some sectarian violence, it is so much better without those fears. I was over in May and there is great fear that that will return as a result of Brexit. Can you tell me what, if any, efforts the Irish government and the representatives of the North who sit in, who are looking at talking, okay, there's a lot of words there that don't make sense, but so let me just try to figure out what they're trying to say. Is there any, are there any efforts by the Irish government to influence the British Parliament and to counter what is going on? Can the Good Friday Agreement still stand, or will it have elements that have to be renegotiated? Please proofread your letters before you send them. Go ahead.
I think the Irish government has been trying to kind of plot a course between Brussels and London, because it's in our interest that Britain gets the best deal possible, because it's our biggest export market and it's our closest neighbor, and we have the North to deal with. The nightmare is a no deal of Brexit, but we're trying not to get to there. But I think they've been trying to, I mean, the Prime Minister's met today, so there's obviously ongoing negotiation, but there's a fundamental change of relationship recently in that we don't, for a long period since the Good Friday Agreement, we were actually able to trust each other a little bit better. Recently, we just don't quite know where that is, and that's not good for the future, I think. Yeah, it's just uncertainty, and in Ireland and the South, we didn't have the right to vote for it, but it's potentially going to be very serious for our economy and our life in general.
All right, let's move on to some other subjects. And
Joe, far be it from me to try to wreck this thing, but you know, the United States Congress is coming back now, and there's the whole question of, you know, Ireland is very important, but the whole question of impeachment and moving forward towards it
was my next thing.
I knew it. I knew it. Yeah, that's great. That's great.
It is exactly. So the question is about we've heard over the last several days of broadening the impeachment inquiry into corruption accusations. So the House Democrats, as Alan mentioned, returned to Washington this week, poised to significantly broaden their nascent impeachment inquiry into President Trump beyond the findings of the Russia investigation. But they will confront a fast dwindling political clock. Undeterred by lackluster public support for impeachment, Democratic lawmakers and aides have sketched out a robust four-month itinerary of hearings and court agreements, court arguments that they hope will provide the evidence that they need to credibly portray Mr. Trump as corrupt and abusing his power. So you'll remember we talked about the story last week about the hush payments to two women. Now Democrats are also demanding documents related to whether his resort properties illegally profited from government businesses and the business of the government. This seems to now be gaining a lot of traction with the tying these two stories together, but with the vice president's visit to Ireland and staying several hundred miles away from the city so he could stay on a Trump property. And then
causing
also,
damage to a carpet, apparently, was the official line.
Yes. And then also there was the story about the Politico story about the Air Force stopping and making stops at in Scotland.
Turnberry, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And Turnberry to stop at the Trump resort for no real apparent reason other than to help a property that was having fiscal problems not have them anymore, because they're doing better as a result of these stays. Congress is back. Most House Democrats now privately agree that Mr. Trump's behavior clears the bar for an impeachment vote. Some reached the conclusion over the six-week recess that just ended, but the politics of doing so are more complicated, and their leaders appear no closer to a decision on whether to proceed. The Judiciary Committee's chairman, Jerry Nadler of New York, has indicated that the panel will most likely determine late this year whether to advance impeachment articles, and aides have privately argued that they cannot wait much longer to leave enough time to vote and try a case in the Senate before the 2020 election more forcefully diverts attention. The clock is the real problem, right, Alan?
Yeah, I think this is a double, triple, quadruple fake out if I ever saw one. Clearly, Nancy Pelosi has been saying that the way we're going to win this election is we're going to bring all of this into an election, and therefore impeachment is premature, and he will be able to claim that he beat it if the Senate doesn't vote positively. In the meantime, you got people like Jerry Nadler and everybody else who understand that the Democrats are furious and they want action. The name of the game? Give them both. Give them both. Let them work their way up to an impeachment. Whether or not they get there is probably irrelevant. What they want to do, or if they get there, they want to get it before the Senate can vote no. I mean, I think that that's what's going on. You got a lot of stuff. Then, of course, the administration is going to say, no, nobody can go up and testify before an impeachment hearing. It's unbelievable, but that's what they're going to say. And so the Democratic strategy clearly is to bring it up to the election, to go slowly, bring it up, and then use that information in your election in 2020.
Right. I think for Nancy Pelosi, it's the journey, not the destination, that matters in this case. But I do not think, I may be wrong in the legal aspect of this, but the hush payments were made before he was elected president. Can you get impeached for something that happened before you got into office?
I think you can impeach for anything, Judy.
For something he did in eighth grade?
You can say, okay, it's Congress's deal to decide, the House of Representatives to deal what you're going to say this is acceptable or not. Okay, take it to its extreme. Suppose on Fifth Avenue he did kill somebody before he was president. Would that be impeachable? Of course it would be impeachable because the House of Representatives says it's impeachable.
I think the issues aren't just limited there. I mean, that was the highlight of the last round of congressional inquiry was that big check on the wall with his signature on it. But just this morning, apparently, some of the Judiciary Committee's resolution for investigative procedures, so the rules of the investigation, were leaked this morning.
Sure.
So the idea is they're going to make sure that they're leaving no stone unturned, so that they can ask all kinds of questions and have a deep list of impeachable offenses, including and incorporating by reference the Mueller report. And that way,
Sarah, both Pelosi and everybody else get their way. Right?
I guess it depends on how those unfold and what's turned up. I think everybody's still waiting for another smoking gun. And the idea is the more that's unturned, either it's a win-win situation, right? You dig up more mud and either you find a diamond or, you know, you find something close enough.
But how many smoking guns do you need?
That was exactly what I was going to ask.
Is there a threshold?
I think Sarah's exactly right. It's the lack of the diamond. You got lots of stuff, but you really need one really good one. You know, the smoking gun is in the Nixon cases, the tapes. What's frustrating to me is that you don't see more people coming forward. There's got to be a lot of that stuff out there. Diamond, indeed.
Diamond.
But you know what's unsettling about this proposal now is the fact that the hearings, many of them will be held behind closed doors. So once again, the public won't know, or their access to information will depend on leaks from committee members, which is, it's always better to actually have the committee work in open rather than leak stuff selectively.
Which we saw in confirmation hearings in the past for Supreme Court justices, for example, Kavanaugh.
Just for an example.
And Booker. Booker being held to the rules of the Senate for exposing information about Kavanaugh.
We do want to, in our final moments here, we have about four of them, to talk about what's coming ahead and the big debate. The big Democratic debate is happening on Thursday. There will only be 10 candidates, is that right? Or do we add an 11th?
I heard that
the billionaire there
got in.
Yeah.
Although that was just Twitter, so it could be totally wrong.
Yeah, I got to check on that. So 10 or 11 candidates. So we're going to be putting that list, cutting it in half, basically, from what it was of the last two debates. Also, the big headline here, of course, is that Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, longtime frenemies, as the Washington Post puts it. Unfortunately, they put it that way. Will finally meet in a debate chasing the biggest prize of all, which is, of course, the presidency. So and not only do you have Warren and Biden on the same stage, but you have Warren, Biden and Sanders on the same stage. And all of the top three are there.
And in New Hampshire, it's getting very, very close. In fact, Biden is losing by a point or two. So those debates may mean a lot. Whether New Hampshire continues to be the leader that will – right now in South Carolina, Biden is way, way ahead. Whether New Hampshire would affect South Carolina, that's another whole thing.
And – but they're weird, right? I mean, they –
You're going to have to be more specific.
meaning in New Hampshire that in the that often we don't really – those primaries don't tell us they can be an outlier.
Right.
They can.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they can be influential. And if you were Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders and you beat Joe Biden there, you'd make as much out of that as you possibly could.
I do think, though, it'll still be more influential for the people who are polling lower. And to see how the field will thin going forward, mm-hmm. which is still at this point of the process the only thing that really matters, because things open up when there are fewer candidates in the mm-hmm. race.
Mm-hmm. And there's a second tier candidate, or probably every second tier candidate is going to try to have a breakout moment where they can stand out, like much like Kamala Harris did. In the last one, and whether or not she can capitalize on. I think Julian Castro stood out last time too, but then they flounder.
And of course, this gives Biden a stage to make a mistake, which right. he's been making all along.
Yeah,
and sort of get himself out of the running, which would really open up the field a lot.
Because I remember it was 2008. Hillary has to win. Hillary has to win. And then she won, but not by much. And then obviously Barack Obama swept everything else.
Yep.
So we'll see what happens. So we get to the debate, and what is it? 3 hours long, right, Judy? 3 hours
and
long.
And it's not going to be on public radio or public television. Once again, we're going to be relegated to a network, correct?
I believe that's correct.
Is ABC?
Yeah, ABC, I think. Yeah. Although they will make it available for streaming, as I think they do, which helps some of us, but not all of us. We'll see what happens. How fun is this for you to watch, Peter?
it's a break from my usual stuff. It's just what gets me always is an election. We're a year and 4 months out. And we're even talking about it's incredible to me, but that's where I come from. It's like 4 weeks and you're done. probably a lot cheaper.
and we are very jealous of that fact.
Actually, yeah.
Doesn't mean we get it right at the end, but right, it's a less costly mistake.
And it's less cheaper, which means you have a far less political influence by big companies or big political organizations, which is a good thing.
Except yeah. I would say here, especially with regard to the issues like immigration and climate change, having those early debates where those were pushed as issues really elevated the conversation. Well, I shouldn't say elevated, turned up the volume on those conversations. And I think that that's sort of like an inherently American thing. I'm glad that the debates give me a break from American politics to actually, in a political setting, get back to the issues that we should be talking about. That's maybe just my emotional reaction to this protracted process, but it feels better as an American to be watching people, Americans, talk about issues that matter to Americans as opposed to cat videos.
Wrestling.
And what wrestling and actresses and whatever else comes out of the president's Twitter feed.
Well, you will get the last word on that one. And thank you very much, everybody. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Sarah Rogerson, and Peter Maloney, thank you all very much for being with us this morning. Enjoy the day. We'll be back right after this.